Chapter 30, Messages from Around the World. Fiona Alexander brought me a bag of cards. It was Eid al-Adha, Big Eid, the holiday when my family went to Shangla. So I thought, how nice, friends have sent me cards for Eid. But how did they know where I was, I wondered. Then I noticed the postage dates. 16 October, 17 October, these were the days right after the shooting. These cards has nothing to do with Eid. They were from people all over the world wishing me a speedy recovery. Many were from children. I was astonished at how many cards there were. You haven't seen anything yet, Fiona said. She said there were 8,000 letters for me. Some were addressed simply Malala, Birmingham Hospital. One was addressed Girl Shot in the Head, Birmingham. There were parcels, too, boxes of chocolate and teddy bears of every size. Most precious of all, perhaps, was a card sent by Benazir Bhutto's children. Inside were two scarves that had belonged to their mother. There were messages from government leaders, diplomats, and movie stars. Selena Gomez had tweeted about me. Beyonce had wished me well on Facebook, and Madonna had dedicated a song to me. There was even a message from Angelina Jolie. It was exciting, overwhelming, and, because my brain was still not working right, confusing. How did Angelina Jolie even know who I was? While I was in a windowless room, unaware of what was happening in the outside world knew exactly what had happened to me. Fiona told me that over 200 journalists from around the world had come to the hospital to see me. Except for that one day when I tried to watch the BBC, I hadn't seen the news since I had arrived. But now I understood. I was the news. People had been praying for me. Dr. Fiona and Dr. Javid and all the wonderful doctors and nurses in Pakistan and England had saved my body. All these people's prayers and support had saved my life. How amazing. While I was feeling so alone in this hospital, wondering about my family, worrying about how we would pay for my care, people from all around the world were worrying about me. I didn't feel so lonely anymore. I couldn't wait to get home and tell Moniba about Angelina Jolie. Chapter 31, A Bittersweet Day. Doctors operated behind my ear for nearly 8 hours, trying to repair the facial nerve that had been cut by the bullet. This was the nerve that had allowed me to open and close my left eye, raise my left eyebrow, and smile. If they didn't do something soon, they'd said, my face would be paralyzed forever. It was a complicated operation. First, they cleared my ear canal of scar tissue and bone fragments. It was then that they discovered my eardrum had been shattered. No wonder I couldn't hear. Then the doctors did the delicate work of removing portions of the damaged nerve and reconnecting it. My job, once the surgery was over, was to do facial exercises in front of a mirror every day. Who knew that such tiny movements could be such hard work? It was 4 months before I could smile and wink. My parents waited for that moment when I could wink and smile. It was my face, of course, but I thought they'd be happiest to have it back. Every day, I had physiotherapy and had to do exercises, learning to get my arms and legs working properly again. How strange to have to work so hard on something that used to be second nature. The first few times I tried to walk, it was exhausting, like wading through a deep snowdrift. By now, it had been almost a month since the shooting. My family was living in an apartment in a tall tower in Birmingham and visiting me every day. And in a sure sign that life was getting back to normal, my brothers were driving me crazy. I begged my parents, leave those two at home. They do nothing but make noise and try to take the gifts I've received. My brothers had gone from treating me like a china doll, a phase that lasted only a day, to teasing, pestering, and generally annoying me. What is all this fuss over Malala? Atal said. I have seen her. She survived. I was finally able to read again and devoured The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, a book given to me by the former Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Gordon Brown. I loved Dorothy's spirit, and I was impressed that even though she was trying to find her way home, she stopped to help those in need, like the Cowardly Lion and the Rusty Tin Man. To me, the moral of the story was that there will always be hurdles in life, but if you want to achieve a goal, you must continue. My language and memory started to come back, too. I was shocked when I looked at the pink notebook Dr. Fiona had given me and saw the questions I had written when I first arrived. Most of them were filled with misspellings and were grammatically incorrect. I still had a hard time remembering some of my friends' names, and I could recall nothing about the shooting. So I worked to show everyone how much I was improving. My progress was steady, and my spirits got better every day. Finally, in December, after nearly 2 months inside hospitals, I was permitted my first trip outside. I was homesick for the lush green hillsides of my valley, so Yima, who worked at the hospital, had arranged a trip to the Birmingham Botanical Gardens. My mother and I went with two nurses. My father didn't go because he had become so recognizable from TV that he was afraid he would attract cameras. On the way, I sat in the back seat of the car, turning my head from side to side to take in everything in a country that was brand new to me. I didn't know what the weather would be like outside. I'd hoped there would be sunshine, but instead I was met with harsh wind and crisp, cold air. There weren't enough jackets and scarves to keep me warm. But the plants, they were gorgeous and strange and familiar. "This one is in my valley, too," I told one of the nurses. "This one, too." I was so overjoyed at being outside, it took me a minute to realize that for everyone else at the garden, it was just a normal day out. My mother was so excited she called my father. "For the first time," she said, "I am happy." 2 days later, I had my first visitor from outside the family, Asif Ali Zardari, the president of Pakistan and the widower of Benazir Bhutto. The hospital was afraid of a media circus, but the visit was an essential one. Mr. Zardari had pledged that the government would cover all my medical costs. So the whole thing was arranged to avoid journalists. I was bundled up in a purple parka and snuck out of the building through the staff exit. We drove right past a flock of journalists and photographers, and they didn't even notice. It was like something out of a spy novel. We were driven to some kind of office, and while we waited, Atal, Kashal, and I played a computer game called Elf Bowling. This was my first time playing it, and I still beat both of them. More proof that the old Malala was back. When the president came in, he was with his daughter, Asifa. They gave me a bouquet of flowers, and then Asifa presented me with a traditional Kashmiri shawl, and Mr. Zardari laid a hand on my head, a gesture of respect in my country. My father cringed a little for fear he would touch the place where my skull had been removed, but it was fine. Mr. Zardari told us he had arranged for a job for my father in Birmingham. He would be Pakistan's education attaché. He told me that everything would be fine and that my job was to concentrate on my recovery. Afterward, he said, I was a remarkable girl, any credit to Pakistan. He was the leader of my country, but he was treating me with respect, like I was the VIP. It was an amazing day. All my worries about how to pay for my care and where my family would stay were lifted. But oh, it was a bittersweet day too, because I understood we would not be going home for a long time.